This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Here's hoping you will like As You Like It at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, that you won't be Pride and Prejudiced just because it's Austin and not the Bard, and that you'll have a Caesar you have never seen before.
Reimagining as if it would be happening today in terms of the political climate, the technology that's involved. So we'll be involving projections, some things with cell phones.
Shakespeare Festival head John Stark talks with GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy. Plus, GLT's new management agreement of Peoria Public Radio Station WCBU is about to go into effect. GLT General Manager R.C. McBride unpacks what that means. And a report on dead bodies and a high school learning experience. Join correspondent Brianna Groh on a trip to the cadaver lab in Leroy and the making of future doctors. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Tomorrow may seem like a normal Saturday. First day of June, kids off school for summer, but here at GLT, it's actually a kind of a big day. We're assuming operations of WCBU, the NPR station in Peoria. It's a move that has been in the works for months. Ryan Denham speaks with our general manager, R.C. McBride, about why it's happening and what it means for both stations.
In the big picture and in the long term, what it means is we're combining the business sides of the house so that in the final analysis, contributors to both radio stations get a higher percentage of their donations going to content. But we're going to have to stage this throughout the summer, and there are a lot of different moving parts. But tomorrow specifically, I don't know that listeners to WCBU are going to notice any changes at all. By the time Monday comes, they'll notice a few more. Later in the summer, they'll notice a few more yet. And even later in the fall, still some more. Most of those changes on aggregate are going to be good ones.
So what is the relationship going to be between WGLT and WCBU? Where will we be separate from each other, and where will there be overlap in relationship?
So primarily the content teams will be separate. So the newsroom specifically in Peoria will cover the Peoria area. And for listeners to GLT right now, the newsroom in Bloomington Normal will continue to cover the Bloomington Normal area. Now, that's not to say that they might not look out for one another, and I would imagine that you as a part of that team, you're going to be able to swap ideas back and forth, tips back and forth, and maybe at some point work on some progress or some projects rather together that benefit both communities. But again, localism is at the core of what we're trying to do here. We have GLT's always done a great job of that, and I feel we're doing better than ever. We're certainly not going to sacrifice that, and we want to replicate that in Peoria for that community. Most of the combination will be on, as I said, the business side of the house. So someone like me will serve as general manager for both entities. Melissa Liebert, our director of development, will serve in that role for both entities. Some of the names that you don't necessarily hear on the air a whole lot, folks like our business manager, Nicole Welsh, same thing. Travis Metters, who's our operations guru. He will serve in that capacity for both. So those sorts of things. And then eventually, we will actually share, this may be too technical, but it is a cost savings for us. We will save our interconnect with NPR and be able to kind of get two for the price of one there and save us some money. But that's still yet to come.
What can you say about the folks who have been hired in Peoria? Who's actually going to be working in Peoria that people should know about?
So we're happy to announce that several folks are staying from the current staff. Daniel Musisi is going to serve as Morning Edition host, and he will continue to host throughout the day and contribute on air in other ways. And he will also be in charge of running the reading information service for the visually impaired, which will continue to operate. Cindy Dermody, who is our longtime corporate support director, will also be continuing. A couple of folks who serve in part-time roles, Kristen McHugh, H. Wayne Wilson, some of those folks are continuing on, and we're very excited about that. We're also going to be bringing some new names in. Tim Shelley, who has spent the last several years at WEEK and WHOI Television, will be joining us in capacity as a digital content director and as a reporter and as an assignment editor. And he is a Peoria guy, went to Bradley University, grew up in Peoria, so he really knows the market well. He'll be joining us a little later in the week. We've also hired a reporter named Dana Vollmer, who will be joining us in a full-time capacity. Very excited about her. She comes to us via Springfield, where she's been covering the State House, and GLT and CBU listeners have heard her on the air before in that role, so she won't be entirely new. And by the time fall rolls around, it's our hope to add another full-time journalist. But in this transition, there could be some cash flow as we transition from Bradley to Illinois State. We just want to make sure that we're in a comfortable position before we go out and hire a full complement of folks. But it is certainly our intention to grow beyond the point we're at.
I think you sort of have alluded to it with the idea of freeing up more money for content creation. But you know, WGLT listeners may be wondering, like, what's in it for me, right? So why do you think that this is a good move for WGLT and its future?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, I think these sorts of partnerships make public radio more viable. And I think there is a way to do that and maintain the locality in respective communities. And that's the model that we are trying to pursue with this sort of partnership. Now, other parts of the country, they don't do that. In some states, and if we have folks listening from other parts of the country, they may be very familiar with a statewide operation where everything is in the largest city or the state capital, and you may have one or two news reporters in outposts throughout the states at individual stations. That's not what we want here. That's not what we want here at all. I think we can have very robust content teams in communities and combine the business and the overhead so that they're just more efficient and more viable for the long term. And then, as we grow revenues, which I'm optimistic we will do, and we thank, as always, all those who contribute to GLT and to WCBU, that will go right back into the product. So I do think it stabilizes and gives GLT more room to grow as well.
So the Peoria media market is a bit different than Bloomington Normal's. There's more TV presence. The Peoria Journal Star is, it's a newspaper like the Pantograph. It is shrinking in staff itself. So where do you kind of picture WCBU fitting into that kind of competitive landscape over there?
Well, the nice thing about being a public media outlet is I don't know that we need to be as quote-unquote competitive as maybe some of the commercial outlets. Now, you and I both have a background in commercial media, and I think I don't mean to put words in your mouth. You may or may not agree with me, but I don't feel the need to be as competitive or as worried about what others are doing. I think we can complement what others are doing. And as you have done with the Pantograph specifically, there are also times where partnerships make some sense. So you may see some of that. That's a long answer. The short answer is I don't pretend to know the Peoria community inside and out. And that's why we need people in Peoria to tell us what they need. We need people who are working in Peoria whose job it is to determine what the needs and wants and desires and expectations are and to make those decisions and help us move forward.
What kind of changes will be coming to the WGLT schedule in the days, the weeks, the months ahead? And does any of that relate directly to what's happening in Peoria?
None of it relates directly. These were all things that were being kicked around anyway. And then when we got to this point, we thought, well, it may make more sense to do some of these all at the same time. So Bruce Bergethon is retiring for a second time, this from his kind of part-time retirement gig as host of Acousticity. And he has some changes that are very exciting in his family that are coming up. So his last show on GLT will actually be this weekend. And that gave us and prompted us to maybe make some of the changes that we were thinking about making anyway with music. So Arielle Jones is going to join us more than she has. She will host Center Stage. That will move, as she has done, but that will move to Sundays in coming weeks. We're going to add World Cafe from WXBN in Philadelphia from 7 to 9 every night. We're really looking forward to that. You're also going to hear some more music shows on weekends, Sound Opinions, All Songs Considered, Conversations from the World Cafe. And then John Norton, who is not only our Morning Edition host, but as I think most of our listeners know, is just has a tremendous ear for music and a tremendous passion and love for music, in much the same way that Bruce does. And he has been kicking around the idea for a while of kind of an evolved format for our blues on weekends. So blues, and he can explain it better than I can, blues will be, you know, part of the a leg of the stool, as will some of the stuff, the Americana and Acousticity music, as will some soul music, some classic rock, probably not a lot of that, but a little bit of that. And then kind of bringing in over the last 20 years, a lot of the really good, I call it new music for grown-ups or new music for intellectually curious grown-ups, and just kind of putting this all into a pot and coming up with something that's really, really fun and interesting and stimulating to listen to. And John has been working very hard on that. And that format is going to debut as kind of an evolution of WGLT's blues. So that'll appear on the stream and during many of the hours that music plays on the air. So, again, not directly related to the changes with WCBU, but, you know, it made sense for the timing. And you're going to start hearing World Cafe in Peoria on WCBU. Eventually, not quite yet, you're going to hear some of the music that we're talking about. And the name for John's music project is Highway 309. Fits in with the Route 66 or the scenic drive motif that we have here in central Illinois. So, but it that will also eventually be heard later this summer in Peoria as well.
So, RC, did we cover everything music related?
One more thing, as the Apple folks used to say, WCBU HD2's classical music service is going to remain, but in coming weeks, and I hope maybe a little sooner than that, you will also be hearing that classical music service on 103.5 FM in Peoria. So the simulcast, as we call it in the business, of WGLT will disappear from 103.5. As part of this, there's probably no real reason to have three NPR signals in one location. So we're taking that and maybe making classical music a little bit more accessible. We've heard that from the Peoria area, that has been missed since WCBU, like us, drifted away from music a little bit and went more news and information. So you won't need a special HD radio to listen to classical music, at least in the heart of Peoria anymore. And again, that'll be coming up within a couple of weeks, and we'll make a very public announcement when that has happened.
All right, so this thing has been in the works for months now. Folks listening to this may have like heard bits and pieces of it kind of floating out and emerging in the news and then our announcement. What about the kind of the partners in all this? Who are the folks other than you who worked on this thing to make it happen?
Well, a lot of people at Bradley University and the Illinois State University made this happen. And, of course, as Bradley University in particular and that radio station has gone through some struggles of late, we are very fortunate at Illinois State and in this community to not only have underwriters and donors who are so appreciative of public radio, but university administration really sees the value in the work that we're doing, and more specifically, Ryan, in the work that you and the news team are doing. And the fact that they have kind of a vision and a faith that this is something important that we're doing, and that by doing a partnership like this, it will, in the long run, make things much more viable and stable for all involved. We're really, really fortunate to have that.
That's R.C. McBride, the general manager of WGLT, and as of tomorrow, also the general manager at WCBU, the public radio station in Peoria. I'm Ryan Denham.
If you are a subscriber to WGLT's e-newsletter, The Scoop, be on the lookout for a message coming Monday from R.C. McBride about all of this. And if you're not a subscriber, sign up now at our website, wglt.org/email.
Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit, with a mobile app tracking buses in real time. No more waiting and wondering at the bus stop. Get connected with Connect Transit. The Connect Transit app is available in the Apple and Android app stores. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a report on a prison library and other things of statewide interest right here on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Most schools are out for summer now, but let's hear about one last educational experience Central Illinois high school students had before going off the clock. It involves doctors and dead bodies. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh reports on a unique high school curriculum, the Cadaver Lab, in the small town of Leroy, population about 3,600 in McLean County.
On any given Saturday morning, the average teen might be getting ready for work, heading to practice or a game, or maybe even sleeping in. But at 8 a.m. on this particular day, a group of around 30 high school students are the only teens in the entire country spending the weekend with cadavers. They've willingly given up 4 hours every Saturday morning over the last several months to study gross anatomy at the law office of Dr. Tom Plura in Leroy. With scrubs, lab coats, glasses, and clipboards, the high schoolers look like the real medical professionals many of them want to someday become. Working in small groups, the students buzz around each of the three cadavers laid out on exam tables inside the lab. Today's lab is dubbed the Gland Finale. The students are tasked with identifying all 12 glands of the human body. After about 30 minutes, anatomist Dr. Martha Sweeney and Proctor Jim Zalesnik circle the room to check the students' work. Dr. Sweeney stops to help a group of students at one of the two male cadavers. They can't seem to find the final two glands.
It's just the liver.
The liver's the gland?
Oh.
Okay. So is the kidney gland? So is the kidney gland too?
Yes.
At the female cadaver, Zalesnik helps the students identify another gland they've missed. He gestures inside the body's chest, just below the neck.
Right down in here. Started with a T. Remember, we talked about it. All we can see in the rest of the cadavers, because they're old, is just a little piece of fat anymore left.
Thymus
gland. And remember, the thymus gland.
Zalesnik explains the thymus gland, part of the body's immune system, disappears as we age. The students are just 17 and 18 years old, and yet they're dealing with subject matter most adults shy away from. But Lisa Tomlin, who teaches advanced placement biology at Normal Community West High School and serves as a proctor for the lab, says the students take a different approach to the experience.
For these young people, the capacity that they have for learning really has made this maybe be an easy transition for them, that in death, these people are still teaching. And so they're looking at it, I think, maybe a little differently. It's not as the end, but really another phase of what the body can do for the future. And so they seem to be able to handle it, honestly, better than most adults that we have come through the doors.
Normal Community High School senior Jake Simonson says while his first day in the lab was a lot to take in, he got used to it pretty quickly.
I really like just getting to learn like a bunch of stuff that I had no idea even existed in our body. Like, it's really cool to see like on the cadaver and then think about how that is, that part of the body is working like in your own body to keep you alive. And that's just like really interesting to think about, that we're all like have the same anatomy going on, and like we are able to see it like firsthand on a real human body.
That excitement about studying medicine is the reason Dr. Tom Plura founded the lab nearly 6 years ago. He hopes the program will inspire students to join the medical practice in some fashion. Dr. Plura says his undergraduate gross anatomy class was the formative experience of his time in school.
Far and away, that was the best class that I ever had, and I want to open that up. There's no reason why you can't offer a similar program to area high school students.
And for the students who do decide to pursue a career in medicine, Dr. Plura says the program gives them a real leg up.
This isn't just somebody watching a doctor or a college professor dissect. The high school students are actually in there dissecting from day one. So there isn't any better way to learn, in my opinion, for a student other than to just jump in and do it.
Mitch Augustine, a senior at Normal Community West High School, says there's another advantage to being in the program.
Actually, this is the only high school experience you can put on your medical school application, so that's, like, amazing. And then, like, if we were to actually go through the physiology and anatomy during class, we would know more than most students in the class, which would be pretty cool.
Leroy School District Superintendent Gary Tipsard says the students aren't the only ones gaining valuable experience in the lab.
You have teachers in our high schools who are teaching anatomy to students who, when they proctor in that lab, they get some of the best professional development that is available anywhere. And so now they can translate that over to 40, 50, 60 kids that they're teaching in their classrooms. So there are so many layers to the impact of trying to do things like this that have a much more significant benefit than what you just see inside the lab.
Tipsard says, to his knowledge, the lab in Leroy is still the only program in the nation that allows high school students to dissect cadavers. He credits the lab's singularity to the innovative partnership between Dr. Plura and the school district. Dr. Plura works with the McLean County Medical Society to buy the bodies. Tipsard and the school district build the curriculum, recruit area students, and secure proctors for the lab. The district also contributes money from a special programming fund to support the lab.
And so when you bring those two types of things together, so business and industry that's willing to do something non-traditional and an educational system willing to do something non-traditional, all to the benefit of young people, that is what made it possible. And that's not everybody embraces that idea.
Tipsard says he continues to hear from educators looking to start their own lab.
Tremont has hosted one in the Peoria area, and we continue to talk to people in the Champaign area about the potential of hosting one in the Champaign area, and we'll see where those things go. But our hope would be that we simply open the door of opportunity for other schools so that we're no longer the only one. That's our hope.
After their final lab, the students turn in letters they've written to the families of the deceased. Mitch and her classmate Michael McKee explained the letters are meant to show their appreciation to the families for supporting their loved one's decision to donate their body.
So it was basically just thank you for helping us with this opportunity to learn about the human body.
Yeah, we couldn't get like really, well, detailed or like too personal because this is like someone's loved one, like they're actual people, but at the same time, like show our appreciation for that opportunity.
And we also told them what we were going into to show like this was not a waste and this, like, we actually used what they gave us.
Dr. Plura says he hears similar feedback from students that show they understand just how unique an opportunity they've been given.
I haven't had a single, not one single student say, no, I'm unhappy that I took the class. Not one. They all just are enamored by it. So I'm confident we're doing the right thing.
The students are confident as well. Several have gone on to medical school to become nurses, veterinarians, and yes, doctors. I'm Brianna Groh.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town.
I just feel that the GLT listeners, the audience, are somewhat the influencers in our community. Hi, my name's Julie Kupsch, and I'm the owner of Specs Around Town.
A GLT underwriter for almost two decades.
Our clients are people that realize the importance of shopping local.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman & Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Now comes word that Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen is resigning his post after only a few years leading that institution. More on that at WGLT.org. Earlier this year, prison staff at the Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois removed about 200 books from a college in the prison program's library. As Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, a lot of the books are about race and some were children's books.
Visiting Day by Jacqueline Woodson. Only on visiting day. Is there chicken frying in the kitchen at 6 a.m.?
This is Rebecca Ginsburg. She directs the Education Justice Project, or EJP. That's a college and prison program at Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois. The program offers University of Illinois classes to incarcerated men at the prison. The children's book Ginsburg's reading is one of about 200 that were removed from the program's library inside the prison. It's about visiting an incarcerated parent.
And maybe Daddy is already up, brushing his teeth, combing his hair back, saying, "Yeah, that pretty little girl of mine is coming today."
Can I ask why you got so emotional?
I think that I got so emotional because the book is a children's book, but it was in our library, the EJP library at Danville Correctional Center. And to think about how many of our incarcerated students have read that book, thinking about their own children, and that the book is now gone, is painful to me.
Ginsburg says the prison's general library contains legal, some fiction, and nonfiction books.
But not anywhere near what would be required for a university student.
That's why Ginsburg says EJP created their own library with a collection of about 4,000 books. Ginsburg says they haven't had much trouble getting books into the prison since the program started 10 years ago. That changed last fall. Books like Uncle Tom's Cabin and Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, weren't allowed in. Then, in January, Ginsburg says prison staff went into EJP's library and removed several boxes of books. The EJP students found out first.
And when I learned that the books had been removed, I felt a pit in my stomach. I felt sick.
EJP staff were forced to take the boxes of removed books back to the U of I campus. Ginsburg says she wasn't given a reason for the removal. So I asked outgoing Illinois Department of Corrections Director John Baldwin.
Somehow, a lot of books got into the institution without going through our review process. That was our fault. We let books in, and some of them maybe shouldn't have been. Some of them are very good books.
Multiple emails between EJP and prison staff show that at least a portion of the books removed from the library were approved by prison staff to enter the facility. So how did prison staff at Danville know that these books didn't get reviewed? I asked Baldwin.
I don't know how the facility found that out. I have no idea.
Ginsburg, however, doesn't buy the review explanation, and neither does Michael Tafoya. He's a former EJP student. I met with Tafoya at the EJP offices on the U of I campus. That's where the removed books are now. We went through them together.
So I see a title up from Savory, Race Matters.
Tafoya and Ginsburg say race is really the issue.
It seems like there's a theme, even though I haven't gone through the boxes. What are they afraid of?
I asked Baldwin why some books aren't allowed in the prison. He referred me to their publication review policy. The policy says material may be barred from a prison because it's obscene or encourages violence. Tafoya says these books didn't cause riots or fights, but he thinks there's a reason prison staff don't want prisoners reading them.
If people like me that come from poverty-stricken neighborhoods learn how to be much more and value ourselves, we're going to be less likely to be breaking the law. And if that happens, then less people are going to go to prison. Less people go to prison, then that means there's going to be less prisons. That means that a lot of people are going to be out of jobs in the future.
Ginsburg says the prison will allow her to submit the removed books through another review process. That's something she plans to do. Meanwhile, Ginsburg and other advocates for education in prison are launching a campaign to get more transparency around how books get into prisons. They plan to lobby lawmakers to pass legislation to ensure something like this won't happen again. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois lawmakers are taking up a statewide construction plan today. For decades, they've traded votes to get a newly paved highway in their town. This is how major road construction plans get approved. But as Illinois Newsroom's Mary Hansen explains, lawmakers are considering a proposal to get rid of that practice.
Construction workers are building the foundation for new tracks at a train crossing in Springfield. The plan includes new underpasses so cars won't have to wait for trains.
It's a safety issue.
Kirk Brown is a senior policy advisor at Hansen Engineering. That's the firm that leads this project.
It's a congestion relief issue for the motorists in Springfield with all these new grade separations to eliminate the rail conflict. But it's also a major economic boost to the community.
Springfield is asking the state for $127 million to pay for the next phase. New tracks and underpasses further south.
The Capitol bill is very critical to this project, just as it is to the rest of the state's infrastructure. I mean, our highways are in terrible shape. The roads are probably the worst shape they've been in years.
Several months ago, Springfield's mayor sent a letter to lawmakers asking for the money as they started negotiating an infrastructure plan. For decades, this is how it's worked. City leaders lobby lawmakers for funds to build new highway lanes or, say, add a crosswalk to an intersection.
That's a very old way of looking at infrastructure investment, a politically driven way of looking at infrastructure investment.
This is Audrey Wenig with the Metropolitan Planning Council, a Chicago-based nonprofit that focuses on sustainable development. Wenig says this old way of thinking must change. Instead, they want funding decisions based on measurable goals.
Ideally, what you would want to do is articulate the goals for your transportation system and compare projects against those goals and then track how projects perform after they're built.
Wenig says transparency in how the state spends its limited transportation money is particularly important as it seeks to raise the gas tax and other fees. She says taxpayers want to know funds are being used wisely.
That they're going to actually make their commutes more reliable, that they're going to have a safer transportation system, that the transportation system is going to get them where they want to go.
The federal government is pushing states toward dividing up transportation money by how well they meet goals, and Illinois is already starting to decide which roads to repave and bridges to repair using performance measures. But Wenig says they want them to use goals for expanding or upgrading the transportation system. Virginia started making its funding decisions this way in 2016. Their system, called Smart Scale, has given out more than $3 billion. Chad Tucker is with Virginia's Department of Transportation. He says the new system changed how people think about a successful transportation project.
In the past, the measure of success was how much tax dollars did I get for my project? Versus now, it's how much benefit can I get the public for the least amount of money.
Under Virginia's system, Springfield would show how adding train tracks would make the city safer and less congested, and why it's a good investment. And transportation officials would weigh their proposal against others and score each of those projects. Chris Mooney says that takes the decision-making power out of legislators' hands.
Politics in Illinois is all about where you pour the concrete. Who gets those roads is often thought about as who's in favor and so forth.
Mooney is a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He says a lot of transportation decisions are already up to engineers and planners at IDOT. Still, vote trading does matter. Mooney says it could change how other deals are made at the State House, big initiatives like legalizing marijuana or sports gambling.
Changing this to a more, you know, completely rational system of allocation of transportation projects is actually probably going to have less effect on transportation and more effect on the politics in the legislative process.
Changing how money is handed out for transportation projects is in at least one infrastructure proposal. And a spokesperson for the governor says they want to use measurable goals in the future to decide on spending. I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
The General Assembly is expected to have a very late night on this last day of the spring legislative session. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. The news can be cold, dark, maybe even a little depressing. Sometimes you just want to have a good old-fashioned story. Subscribe to GLT's newest podcast, The Next to Normal Story Slam. You'll hear authentic, heartfelt, and often hilarious stories from each monthly slam. Subscribe to The Next to Normal Story Slam on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at WGLT.org/Story Slam. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Missouri and Planned Parenthood have been in a standoff over the final remaining abortion clinic in the state, and today its future rests in a St. Louis judge's hands. As IPR's Sarah Fenton reports, Planned Parenthood lawyers are seeking a restraining order to keep the state from using regulations to close the clinic.
Governor Poison, I'm going to say it just like the sign says. When politicians lie, people die.
The battle over abortion rights in Missouri has spilled from the courtroom into city streets. On Thursday, Planned Parenthood supporters gathered in the shadow of the St. Louis Arch to demand state officials stop trying to limit access to abortion. Activists already were incensed that last week Republican Governor Mike Parson signed a bill that will soon outlaw abortion after 8 weeks. That would make Missouri one of the most restrictive states in the country. Then this week, Planned Parenthood announced that the last abortion clinic in the state could close in a matter of days because state regulators refused to renew the clinic's yearly license. Just a few blocks away from Thursday's protest, Judge Michael Stelzer was hearing arguments from Planned Parenthood's lawyers. They accused the state of using the license investigation as a pretense to shut the clinic down.
Governor Parson, get your hands out of the vaginas of Missouri women.
That's Mevy Mead, director of Planned Parenthood Advocates in Missouri, speaking on the steps of the civil courts building after the hearing.
It's shame on Missouri politicians and Missouri government for weaponizing the licensing and regulatory process to end safe and legal abortion in Missouri.
But Parson and other state officials say the investigation into the clinic isn't political. Randall Williams is the director of the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, which oversees the licensing process. He spoke to NPR's Audie Cornish on Thursday.
6 million people in Missouri, I'm sure many are pro-life, many are pro-choice, but our duty is to maintain the public trust by regulating these facilities such that they follow the law, regulations, and keep people safe.
State officials say they need to interview several physicians who have worked at the clinic to investigate what officials call several deficiencies in patient care. The state's lawyer on Thursday cited an instance of a patient being rushed to the hospital after an abortion. But clinic doctors say they've fixed all the issues the state found during its annual inspection earlier this spring.
If it was about health and safety of our patients, the Department of Health has the power and prerogative to stop our provision of care the moment they identify a safety concern.
David Eisenberg is an OBGYN and the clinic's medical director. He says the clinic now requires that the same doctor who consults with a patient before an abortion also performs the procedure. But he says now the state wants to keep digging. State health officials want the clinic to make 5 other physicians available for questioning before they renew its license. But Planned Parenthood says they were or are independent physicians. Those physicians, under their own lawyer's advice, have refused to talk. Eisenberg says the state's quickly changing regulations and inconsistent enforcement leave those people, many at the start of their medical careers, at risk of criminal prosecution.
And the fact is that this year, the state has somehow reinterpreted the rules to believe that we are not compliant with rules that haven't changed.
If the judge doesn't grant the restraining order or the state doesn't grant a renewal, the clinic's license will expire at midnight. With that, Missouri would become the first state in the country with zero abortion clinics. When that happens, abortion rights advocates say the women who will be affected the most will be the poor and disadvantaged who can't afford the time or money it takes to travel to a clinic. Michelle Landau is the board president of the Gateway Women's Access Fund, which provides financial support to women seeking abortions.
Missouri is already in what's considered an abortion desert, where the majority of Missourians live over 100 miles from a clinic. So closing clinics is just going to make that distance even worse.
The judge can make a decision based on two arguments, lawyers say. He could rule that because the clinic is the last abortion provider in Missouri, closing it would interfere with a woman's constitutional right to an abortion. The judge could also accept Planned Parenthood's argument that the state is performing an open-ended inspection that is, quote, arbitrary and capricious. As the state and the nation await the judge's decision, the clock ticks down on Missouri's lone abortion clinic. I'm Sarah Fenton.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, supported by listeners like you. Life gets hectic quickly after you wake up. GLT's new daily podcast will cut through the noise. GLT's The Leadoff is Bloomington Normal's first daily podcast. You'll get our biggest story of the day, plus events and meeting previews, everything you need to know to start your day. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at WGLT.org/leadoff. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. For a play to survive hundreds of years, it needs to be adaptable to changing audience tastes. This season at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, three plays demonstrate just how far their narratives and characters can stretch to reach the hearts and minds of modern viewers. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The Illinois Shakespeare Festival is giving you a Caesar you've never seen before. It's hitting new notes with As You Like It, and unveiling a crisp new Pride and Prejudice. All three plays at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival this season are adaptations directed by those who did the adapting. Never standing still, the festival is making all this happen with the help of a new sponsor. Festival Artistic Director John Stark says the organization reached out to form a new partnership with the Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group.
We are partnering with Epiphany Farms to create packages for dinner and a show. Each of them will be discounted a certain amount. You could eat at one of the eateries that they have, Anjou Above, Bakery and Pickle, Epiphany Farms, have dinner, and then go to see a Shakespeare play. So we're very excited about that. Another part of that is that we're creating what we're calling the Bard Bus. If you happen to live in the Peoria area, ooh, we are going to be having a bus that on different occasions that will be highlighted on our website for more information. This bus will leave from Peoria, drive you to the Epiphany Farms restaurant, then take you to the Shakespeare Festival show, and then take you home. And all of that for an all-inclusive sort of event leaving for Peoria.
It sounds like you're really making an effort to bring people over from Peoria and also to make the Shakespeare Festival about, not just about plays, but it's a whole big thing. It's a whole big evening for people.
Yeah, that's part of making the experience. And part of that is something else I want to talk about, and that's jazz on Saturday nights at the festival. We've had jazz the last few years. Last year we also did Saturday nights, but this year we're expanding to six Saturday nights out at the festival, and that happens in the courtyard, and it then helps make a whole evening of entertainment, jazz and then the production that night. And
are you going to have Glenn Wilson again?
Glenn Wilson is coordinating it all, and he will be playing at various nights, but he also brings in a whole cadre of friends. There's a lot of people in the community are jazz aficionados, and they love that. And this is a free thing that we offer to the community. You actually can come see the jazz without seeing the show those evenings. It starts at 6:30 in the courtyard on each Saturday night, except July 13th, because July 13th we're opening Caesar in the theater where we're sitting next to right now, the CPA Theater at ISU.
Well, why do we have to have Caesar in the CPA? Is there a lot of technology going on with that show?
There is. That's the major thing. We're really excited about this piece. It's a new adaptation by director Keta Carpenter. Keta's been with us before in 2015 and 2018 as an actor, and she's adapted Caesar over the last 2 years of working on this script, reimagining as if it would be happening today in terms of the political climate, the technology that's involved. So we'll be involving projections, we'll be involving some things with cell phones and live feed, and some of those things will happen. So all that technology is much easier to achieve in an indoor facility, and also, I should say, in air-conditioned comfort where there'll be no rain.
Caesar, for you, is a family affair, because you were doing the production design.
Yes.
And your son, Nathan, is playing Caesar in this, and your wife, Lori Adams, also has a role in this. That is very cozy.
It is very cozy, yes. Yeah, so yes, I get to see my son face the Ides of March, as it were.
I don't think it comes out well.
Well, you know, you got to see how this version comes out, I guess. So there's the mystery.
Really?
No.
Oh.
No. we're still steeped in Shakespeare's story and the language, but Keta has linked it together and put some characters together and streamlined the whole event. So we're looking at a two-hour traffic across the stage for Caesar. But yes, my family is heavily involved in that production.
So all three plays that you have this season, Caesar, As You Like It, and Pride and Prejudice, they're all adaptations. Is that a trend now, particularly with classic plays, to do adaptations of them?
Yes, I would say so. I think everyone is looking for, using Shakespeare as a way to comment on today's world. And I would say that almost any Shakespeare you see in the nation is adapted to some extent. If not, every production of Hamlet you would see would be 4 hours long.
Because absolutely.
There's always some editing and some rearrangement or tying things together and to tighten things up for our today's audience. But yes, Pride and Prejudice by definition is an adaptation because we're going from Jane Austen's book. The As You Like It that we're doing, Robert Quinlan and Jordan Cofftrey returned. They did our version of Midsummer Night's Dream in 2017.
So we have more music here?
Yeah, more music, yes. Jordan is composing music. He is playing Touchstone for us, and he is going to be the supplier of entertainment and merriment in the production. But he's written 10 pieces of music, and the cast will perform these. There's already music in As You Like It, but they've expanded that and really made it a sort of a musical journey through the play. Again, the bass is totally based in Shakespeare's story and his verse and poetry, but I think we augment it with Jordan's music and Robert's adaptation of tightening of some of the scenes and so forth.
And they've set the play in the World War I era, so that's going to influence just what type of music that Jordan is composing.
They started off with sort of English music hall sort of quality to it, and I think it has that quality. It's just pre-World War I. It's right in that era, right as we're getting to that era in the world. And so I think the people will really enjoy it. It's very listenable music, and it's very fun. And those patrons of ours that have seen Jordan before, he's beloved in terms of how he approaches his roles and how personable he's on stage, etc.
Three plays have been adapted, and the people who adapted the plays are being the directors. What are the advantages of that?
They have a vested interest in making it work and work well, and they're going to be also staging the play that they're adapting. And so as they have been working through, they've been working out tracking of characters, and also that I think they keep a mind on blocking about how they would move people around the stage as they've adapted these and how will they stage this. Because sometimes, occasionally, playwrights sort of leave that up to the directors and the producers, but in this case, every director has been adapting the work, and so they are keeping that in mind as they go, and they're totally invested as well.
Let's talk about Pride and Prejudice for a moment. Much beloved Pride and Prejudice. Mm-hmm. There have been multi-versions of that for movies and for TV and different stage adaptations as well. Do you see Jane Austen for us today as something of a source, a well that we go to, much like we go to Shakespeare?
Well, I think so. That's why part of the reason I chose it is that it is a classic story. It is a beloved book and all across the world, really. And so I think those classic stories is what we're all about this year. Caesar is a classic story. There are all sorts of lines of Caesar from that. But Pride and Prejudice, I think, fits that mold of a classic that we're putting on stage. And Deanna's written a faithful but very tight adaptation of the Pride and Prejudice that I think people will really enjoy and have fun with.
Yeah, when somebody knows something that well, they're going to go to it with a certain level of expectation. Are they going to have my favorite line in the play? You know, there's that as well. So you've got expectations that are already there for audiences. So that's a tough order, but you think she's going to fill it?
I think so. What I see on the page and the actors that we have brought together, I think are going to be, will delight the audience, and I think you'll be very satisfied with that view of it.
Do we have the return of theater for young audiences?
Yes, we do. We will be performing on Thursday and Saturday mornings at Ewing on the lawn there at 10 o'clock in the morning. And this year we're doing another play by Nancy Steele Brokaw, local playwright. She's prolific in this community in terms of what she provides and writes for the community. And her show is called Who Stole Cleopatra? And I'll just say that we see a young Will Shakespeare who's struggling to come up with his next show. And he's written a version of Cleopatra and someone steals it. Every night you come to Ewing, there's going to be entertainment of some sort, pre-show entertainment, either a green show or jazz. The other thing is on Thursday, Fridays, and Saturday nights, we'll have food trucks as well. So that's available, plus our concessions, our gift shop. And as usual, you can bring your picnics out before the show, enjoy the beautiful grounds of Ewing Cultural Center, which is the best place in the world to see Shakespeare.
That's John Stark, Artistic Director of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, which kicks off its new season June 27th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
John Stark says some of the most popular apps at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival are the weather apps festival staff consult all summer long. In case of bad weather, there's no rain stage. The festival's Facebook page is where rain cancellations are announced. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. That is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Brianna Groh, Ryan Denham, General Manager R.C. McBride, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.